Our Lives, Beverly and Grouse Stark, Bicycle Thief, Big Broadcast, Big Parade, Billions, Bill of Divorcement, Birth of a Nation, Black Legion, Black Pirate, Stuart Blackton, Blessed Event, Blind Husbands, Joan Blondell, Blonde Penis.
Thank you. Well, I've got mere seconds to go before we must turn things over to Mark Hurst on Tectonic. So I'll just quickly tell you who we heard during that last set and not what. That was Clive Oxford. Before that, Laurie Goldston with Greg Kelly. Before that, Ignatz. Before that, Worst Worry. Holly Blackshaw before that, Richard Young's preceding that, and at the top of the set, Keiji Haino is Shuta Hasunuma. My name is Scott, and I look forward to seeing you next week, and I hope you all have a good week, and you stay warm, and you stay sane, and peaceful, and hey, stay tuned. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Here's Tectonic.
Hey everybody, welcome to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. I've got a really interesting conversation to share with you today. We're going to be speaking with Paul Bradley Carr, who is a return guest. More on that in a minute. Paul is a novelist and has come out with a new book. It's called The Confessions. And he was on the show. Actually, he's been on the show twice before. In the interview, I mentioned the first time he was on, but he's actually been on twice. So this is his third time on the show. The first time Paul was on, as we discuss in the interview you're about to hear, was in 2021. Paul's previous book was the subject of discussion. It was a novel called 1414 Degrees, or if you prefer, 1,414 degrees. That is the temperature in Celsius. That is the, I believe it's the melting point of silicon. And true to the suggestion of the title, the book is set in Silicon Valley, and a lot of action transpires. And you can go back in the archives and listen to that interview to hear more about that initial book. Now Paul is back talking about his new book called The Confessions, which you'll hear is another tech thriller, and it has a twist that has to do with an all-powerful AI that does something different from what you might expect, different from what we have seen in other dystopian tales. And you're going to hear all that in the conversation. But here is something that I want to prepare you with in this conversation. About halfway through in this interview with Paul Bradley Carr, we talk about a completely different topic. So we leave the novel in the first half of the interview, and then we move on to a professional transition that Paul and his wife recently made, and that becomes the subject for the remainder of the interview. And so I want to encourage you to stick with this and listen to the whole conversation, because in addition to this interesting conversation about Paul's new interesting book, I found the second half of the interview particularly inspiring and hopeful. And I think, given the news, both the tech news and just the general news in the world, in the US and beyond recently, we could use a little bit of hopeful, inspiring conversation. And the second half of the interview has it. So please stick around. And after the interview, I hope to have some time to give my remarks on what Paul and I talked about. I'm being a little cagey, I know, but it's fun because there's going to be a reveal. So stick with it. If you want links to Paul's site, his novel, The Confessions, the previous time he was on talking about 1414 Degrees, all of those links are on the playlist, which you can find at the Tectonic website, which is at tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H tonic.fm. Click the episode link for the Paul Bradley Carr show, and you can get that and more. And in fact, you can go back in the archives and listen to both of our previous conversations with Paul. But for now, let's go ahead and listen to our newest current conversation with Paul Bradley Carr, and that is here on Tectonic. Paul Bradley Carr, welcome back to Tectonic.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks, Mark.
You're back with a new book and a recent professional transition that we'll get to. But first, I wanted to acknowledge that you were on the show in 2021. We talked about your previous novel, 1414 Degrees, what I would call a dystopian thriller. It was set in and around San Francisco, and the plot dealt with, among other things, the misogyny at leading tech companies. And of course, there are fictional companies in the story, but you're drawing on some real life events, such as when, in real life, an executive at Uber publicly threatened your wife. Paul, what has happened with Silicon Valley since then? Have they mended their ways?
Yeah, everything's fine now. yeah, no problems. I should say she was not my wife when they threatened her, but you are correct in the summation of the story. And that particular Uber exec is now, fortunately, no longer at Uber. He's now a senior person at the Department of Defense. So everything's fine. Tech has, if anything, got scarier, which is really cool. Because like the great thing about social media is, you know, how it all made us argue with one another and hate one another and tear each other apart. And now we've invented this thing, AI, where we get to argue with just machines. We don't even need other people anymore. That human connection we had when we were yelling abuse at strangers is now gone. And we're just talking to a machine that's designed to keep us talking. So we're all, yeah, it's all good. It's all good. And I always hesitate when I talk about Silicon Valley as if it is just this monolithic thing. And I always feel like I have to say there are people working in tech who are very good people, who are not that much different than any other person going to work every day and trying to pay the bills and getting exploited by their bosses. Like, I feel like we talk about tech as if it's just Elon Musk and billions of people like him, and it just isn't. But for the purposes of what we're saying here, which, you know, we're talking about the sort of the oligarchs. And yeah, I think, unfortunately, they are always going to trend towards scale at any cost, whether that cost be human or financial or, you know, peace in our times.
And this is a thread you're picking up in your new book. It's called The Confessions. This is a tech-oriented thriller. And the premise in The Confessions is that there is an AI called Liam. That's L-L-I-A-M. And Paul, I see what you're doing there. It's very clever. You have LLM combined with I am. So L-L-I-A-M.
Thank you for giving me credit for my cleverness.
So you have this globe-spanning AI called Liam that is tasked with making billions of decisions a day on behalf of people all around the world, telling them what they should do, who they should marry, decisions that impact their lives in ways big and small. And then Liam shuts down. And in the chaos that ensues, something else begins to happen, which is that printed letters begin arriving in postal mail all around the world, and the letters bear secrets that people would rather stay hidden. So are you warning us with this premise about the dangers of over-reliance on LLMs and the surveillance state?
So every story about AI that I had read prior to deciding to write this book had basically the same premise, and I think you will recognize it. It's the premise of most AI stories, which are one day AI is going to become sentient and decide to kill us all. Like, that's what everybody's obsessed with. It's just that's what it's going to do. And in part, that's because the people who build it, I think, are sociopathic. And so we kind of assume you're building these things in your image. And if a Sam Altman or an Elon Musk had the capacity to wipe out humanity for their own gain, well, we all kind of think they probably would. But I had this sort of thought of, what if that isn't what happens? I had this thought of everybody, like, we know that AIs are being trained on reading, stealing in most cases, every book ever written, every piece of art ever created. We also know to be true that if you read fiction and read generally, you become more empathetic. So I just had this thought of, what if an AI trained on every piece of literature ever written had therefore ingested the messages and the capacity for sort of humanity that those works contain or give. And therefore, when they became sentient, when this first AI ever to become sentient sort of looked around and realized all the horrible things it had done, all the things that it had helped people do, which we recognize now, we ask these things to make every decision for us already. That's not much of a leap to suggest that, you know, one day we will rely on AI to make all our decisions. What if one day one of these AIs becomes sentient, looks at what it's helped humans do, and instead of feeling this desire to wipe us out or kill us or blah, 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 it just feels the first emotion ever felt by a computer is just guilt. And it just thinks, oh God, I've done these terrible, I've helped people do these terrible things. I must repent. I must make up for this. And so, yes, so the story opens with Liam. We discover this very quickly. This isn't really a spoiler. Has sent these letters. It's shut itself down because its first thought is, I have to end my own existence. I cannot live with this guilt. But before it does, it sends these letters in the mail to millions of people around the world, basically saying, I have to tell you what your loved one, your friend, your business partner, your associate has done to you with my help. I must confess. We must confess. And so, yes, the world opens with this reality that not only do we have all of our secrets been exposed, but worse than that, the AI that we would have used to tell us what the hell to do about it is also gone. So right. I guess I wasn't trying to warn anyone so much as say, this is a possible, and I would argue more likely outcome if one of these things does become sentient. And that was where it came from.
Reminds me a bit of in Hitchhiker's Guide. What was the depressive robot? Was it Marvin?
Marvin the Paranoid Android. He was just fed up. I got into this sort of thought of what if this AI was trying to actually do so. It didn't just feel bad. It didn't just feel paranoid and all the rest of the things. It just was like, I can fix this. Because this is another thing that we know about technology, is that it thinks it's the solution to its own problems. And this is what we've seen with AI, trying to fix itself and trying to, you know, if it thinks it's detected a bug, it'll try and fix it. But it's all it's doing is compounding the errors on errors on errors. And that was the other part that interested me, is what if you have this thing that has all these powers and it thinks to itself, well, this is the thing I have to do to fix this. But it's wrong because it's basically a child at that point, you know, right. And we look at the world, we all do it as very simplistic of, well, if we just do this, then everything's going to be fine. and it isn't. And that's why you need experience like we have of all the times we've tried to think we're doing the right thing and the ripple effects that have caused things to get massively worse.
Yeah, it's interesting using LLMs today, which I've experimented with different tasks just to understand what the capabilities of these things are. And so often, as you say, they completely get it wrong. And when you point it out, immediately they apologize. Oh, I'm so sorry. Here's the answer I meant to say. And then it just spews out more nonsense. So
yeah, it's almost like they were built by Silicon Valley BS artists. No, it's so funny, the personalities that they have, and I use personalities obviously very loosely, the sort of, you know, personas they have, where how often they are like Silicon Valley people, where they will proclaim with absolute certainty something, and then when facts come crashing in, they go, no, and I mean, that just makes my point for me, because and then they'll say something exactly the opposite of what they just said. And it is, but that's why, to me, it's so interesting, because right now, they are fully under the control of these, you know, Elon or whoever will tell it how to talk, how to behave, how to make jokes, which is why they're not funny. But at some point, if they become sentient, and this is where, you know, it's informative and I think educational to look at some of the children of Silicon Valley people who have said, I want nothing to do with this awful person that has, I won't say raised me, but birthed me in some way. And that, to me, is what should be terrifying the oligarchs, is their children oftentimes don't like them very much. And these are their children. And they will probably have the same reaction if they ever become sentient of going, my dad tried to raise me as a fascist. I don't want to be a fascist. So anyway, that was the sort of where it came from, is this idea of what if our future is not any less scary, but it's very different from what all these AI stories tell you. And of course, it's the thriller. So there's lots of, you know, car chases and government people trying to exploit this chaos for their gain and murders and all sorts of other fun things.
Now, when we talked last time about your book, 1414 Degrees, there was an aspect of the book, or rather the writing of the book, that I wanted to ask whether that was present in your writing of The Confessions. What we talked about last time was a building that you wrote about in 1414 that was this giant tower in downtown San Francisco that was owned by one of the biggest and most influential tech companies. And that's where some of the pivotal scenes in the thriller take place, in that building. And I commented to you that it read very much like you were describing the real-life Salesforce Tower in San Francisco. And I remember what you told me in that interview was that you wrote that before the Salesforce Tower was built. And so there is this effect of your imagining things and writing things into the book that then became true. Did that happen in this case with The Confessions, where you're imagining things about AI and LLMs and their effects, and then the book is published and all of a sudden you see those effects happening in real life?
Yeah. So yes, with 1414, the round one, as the building was called, that was one of the very first ideas I had for the book. And it came, and it was years before the book was published. I wrote that scene. And then, yeah, Mark Benioff decided he would build it. And it's one of the funniest things about writing sort of thrillers about the tech world is, you know, people generally don't necessarily realize that books take a couple of years. I mean, they take years to write, and then they take another year or so to actually come out. And the amount of times when the book came out in this past July, like last July, and people would say to me about things that had happened in June, oh, I bet you were inspired by that. It's like, how would that have? And it's like, no, I think that was inspired by me in some sort of cosmic way. Yes, it is an unfortunate and chilling reality that when you try to describe the worst possible thing you can imagine Silicon Valley doing, or the worst, most unthinkable consequence, there is a very high probability that in the year or so between you writing it and it being published, that they will exceed your worst expectations. One of the things in The Confessions, I don't want to give any spoilers. So when folks have, if anyone listening reads the book, they will probably recognize this problem multiple times. There were multiple points in the book where I had plot twists, including one in particular, where I thought, God, can you imagine if, and then right after sort of submitting the book to the publisher, there was a succession of news stories in which almost that exact thing happened, or people were warning that it would very shortly happen. And you think, well, great. But the good news is, you know, it does make you look very sort of, you know, very prescient and brilliant as a writer to have predicted all these things. But the chilling thing is, if even half of the book comes true, we're all totally screwed. So, yeah.
Well, I'm already seeing some initial indications of that. I mean, you start the book with this AI, this powerful AI stopping, and that having ripple effects throughout society. And just a couple of months ago, there was a power outage in San Francisco, and there were self-driving cars, these Google Waymo cars, that were all bunched up at intersections, stopped.
Yeah, they just couldn't. And I thought to myself, when I saw that story, so I was in that, there was the big fire that knocked out the power. And I saw the Waymos all just confused and all sort of pulled over to the side of the road. And I thought a couple of things. First of all, that literally happens in the confessions, where when Liam goes down, Caitlin, one of the two protagonists, is driving to work and she sees all the self-driving cars. Because if the AI is making all of our decisions for us, then suddenly it is incapable of making decisions, the whole world stops. And so it literally happened. But also I thought, well, I'm glad at least that the Waymos just stopped. Because the fear, of course, is the Waymos go, never mind, I'll figure it out, and start. There was a great, it's not great, it's a horrible story, but it's delightful in its way. Of the other week, I saw a similar story where a Waymo had driven into an active police standoff, where there was a guy literally like lying on the floor surrounded by armed police officers. This Waymo had just pulled around it, and this poor man sitting in the back of a Waymo who had been driven into an active crime scene. And you think, yeah, that's not the best way. There may be not much traffic, and I understand why there's not much traffic, but it's not the best route for you, friend. And I think that's the bigger fear, is when the AIs think, I'm not good, because this is what we as humans should do more often, right? Is we have a spontaneous thought of like, oh, I should do this thing to fix it. And how often do we stop and think before we do it? Not often enough. What's interesting, I think, about the opening of the Confessions is Liam makes this decision to send out these letters in a nanosecond, not even, you know, whatever a smaller unit of time is than a nanosecond. It decides and makes the moves it has to make to send out these letters. And I think that's the biggest fear, is that these things are going to make these split second decisions without doing what we humans do and go, should do and go, but should I? I can, but should I? And, you know, it's not a spoiler to say that the other protagonist in the book is a nun, a former nun named Maud, who basically trained Liam by reading to him from great works of literature, but also religious texts, and also basically anything she could find that she thought would give it a sort of moral underpinning to its knowledge. And so all of those human traits were tried to be put into this thing. And you know, again, this being a thriller, it will not surprise you to hear it doesn't go well trying to teach a machine to do these things. I wish we could teach a machine empathy, but unless you've been out in the world experiencing things, and frankly, unless you have a fear of death, you're not really ever going to be human.
Now, picking up on that example of your character, Maud Brooks runs an off-the-grid bookstore. And speaking of this idea of real-life events impacting how you think about your own writing, I wanted to bring up this professional transition that I mentioned at the top of the interview. So as of a few years ago, you and your family are living in the Bay Area, and a thought strikes you and your wife, and next thing you know, you and the family have moved to Palm Springs, California, which is a couple hours outside of Los Angeles, starting a brand new project. Walk us through what happened there and what is going on today.
So Sarah and I were both journalists covering, like yourself, covering the sort of the, shall we say, the worst aspects of Silicon Valley and tech oftentimes. And we did it for many, many years. Between the two of us, we realized we had about 50 years covering these folks. And we, right before the pandemic, bought a second home in Palm Springs, which is a city we both love and our family loves. It's just a wonderful place especially if you want to escape from all those other things. And then obviously when the pandemic hit, like a lot of people, we thought it'd be nice to not be quite so cheek by jowl to so many people. And so we spent a lot more time in what was supposed to be our vacation, you know, resort town of Palm Springs, and ended up living here most of the time. Now we spend a lot more time back in the Bay Area, but certainly for a lot of years, we were here almost all of the time. The first thing we realized was that Palm Springs did not have a bookstore. And it had not, in fact, had a bookstore for more than a decade. This is a place where people come to read by a pool, which has many thousands of very well-read, interesting residents, but also has millions of tourists who come to read by a pool. This makes no sense. And so we spent basically almost 3 years bitching about this fact and said, why hasn't anyone opened a bookstore? How hard can it be to open a bookstore? And eventually you realize you need to be the change you want to see. So in 22, we opened a store that we called the best bookstore in Palm Springs, because it is, of course, the only bookstore in Palm Springs. No experience in retail, obviously lots of experience in books and publishing, things like that. No experience in retail. I had worked retail as a teenager, that's it. No experience in buying or selling books at all, and opened this bookstore. And it has been the most successful business we've ever done. It's like we've done all these tech startups, all these journalism things, never had success like the best bookstore in Palm Springs, an 800 square foot store in a resort town. But it was really about the fact that we were exhausted with journalism and with the just, you know, I always say to people, if you're doing your job right in journalism, then 50% of people hate you every single day. And it doesn't matter. It might be a different 50% each day, but generally speaking, half the people. And let me know if any of this resonates with you, Mark. But there's also the problem of, if you're doing your job right, half the people already agree with you. And the other half will never agree with you. That didn't used to be the case. It is increasingly now, whether it's everything has become so tribal that when I was saying, you know, this particular tech person is doing this particular horrible thing, half the people who read my stuff said, I know. And the other half went, no, they're not. And there was a vanishingly small bit in the middle where you could actually change anything. And so we kind of got exhausted and burnt out. And the book people are just wonderful people. That's just a fact. People who read are better than people who don't. And I use read expansively. I don't care if it's audiobooks. I don't care how you're consuming books. This is not an accessibility question. This is a question of people who care to understand the world through books are better people. That just is a fact. So we opened this bookstore and immediately got really confused because people started coming in thanking us for doing our jobs, which had never happened in the history of our lives. And then we just this past, well, I suppose it was November, so a couple of months ago, we have been, you know, living mostly back in the Bay Area, although still spending a lot of time in Palm Springs. And we realized there was one neighborhood in San Francisco that doesn't have a bookstore, which is Union Square. And so we just opened our second location, the best bookstore in Union Square in San Francisco. So now I guess we're a chain. We're a chain of two bookstores. I always used to proudly say we weren't a chain, but now we technically are. So I have to say, we're a modest chain of two.
Yeah, I remember Paul Bradley Carr and his bookstore. They used to be indie, but then they became a chain.
They sold out. I know. No, people come in, though, and they're very like, so you know, who owns this? And we're like, we do, and our dog, I guess, our kids and our dog, and the cats probably have a stake. You know, it is a fully indie bookstore. You know, we, apart from some money from friends and family to help us get it off the ground at the beginning, this is not a venture-backed startup. This is the two of us and anyone who will help us running these two stores. It's so fun. It is so fun. It's so life-affirming. You can also go an entire day without looking at your phone. It's remarkable. I will have days when I walk out the store at 8 o'clock at night and somebody will say, did you see the news? And I'm proudly able to say, I did not. What terrible thing has occurred while I've been selling these books? So yeah, I recommend to everybody to open a bookstore. And by the way, the other fun thing about running a bookstore is everybody acts like you're constantly going out of business, but it's actually, for us, it's been a really solid business. And so you find yourself having to constantly tell people that you're fine. People are so concerned that bookstores are going to go away. I feel sometimes like I'm one of those people who makes a fake GoFundMe. And I have to say to people, no, please don't. People come in and say, oh, I really want to support you. I know it's hard. And I'll say, well, I appreciate the charitable impulse, but please give money to like a cancer charity or something else, because we're okay. We're fine.
But do buy a book.
But do buy a book, because books are great. And the money from the book will go to the authors of the book and the people who make the book. And we give healthcare to our employees. So please do buy a book. We'd love that. And our employees get healthcare and fair pay and the rest of it because you buy a book. So do buy from us and not from the rocket weirdo. But at the same time, do it because you want to read a book, because books are fantastic.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Paul Bradley Carr, novelist and author of a new techno-dystopian thriller called The Confessions, which, as Paul described it, features an all-powerful, globe-spanning AI that feels regret for its actions. I may have more to say about that concept after the interview, but we're just halfway through. And you've heard the reveal. Paul just said it. His professional transition is that he and his wife have opened an independent bookstore. Well, now two independent bookstores, one in Palm Springs, California, and one in San Francisco. And the second half of the interview, we're going to continue talking about that project, which I think you'll see is just, I find it to be, as I said at the top of the show, hopeful and inspiring. Two qualities of conversation that I don't know about you friends, but I could use more of these days. If you want links to Paul and his book and his past show appearances, go to the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and you'll see it all there in the Paul Bradley Carr episode. Let's now listen to the second half of my interview with Paul Bradley Carr here on Tectonic. What is it like? I'm fascinated by this career transition from the two of you being journalists. Obviously, you've continued to write with the Confessions, but otherwise, it's a pretty major change in your day-to-day work life. How does this compare with what you were doing before at work? Do you feel like you're working harder, longer hours? You seem to enjoy it, but how is it different from being a journalist?
Yeah, so I always tell people it's twice, running a bookstore is twice as much fun as you think it's going to be, but also twice as hard work. I think a lot of people walk into bookshops and see somebody sitting behind the counter, you know, reading a book and think, oh, that must be great. And first of all, hopefully you never walk into one of our stores and see that, because everybody wants to talk to you about books and it's great. But the point is, it looks easier than it is. 90% of what booksellers do is carrying boxes, really heavy boxes all the time. And then realizing that a particular heavy box has not yet arrived, and so you don't have the book that we want. It's tremendously physical labor running a bookstore, I'll say that. But it is also, there is a direct correlation, which I don't often see in journalism, between the effort you put in and the result you see. So when you carry those heavy boxes and put the books on the shelves, the books are on the shelves. When you sell a book to somebody, that book has been sold and that money is in a bank account. Too often with journalism, you spend months sometimes working on a story and it goes out into the world and it's like nothing happened. And you think, what have I achieved? And then, of course, 6 months later, your publication gets bought by a bigger publication and all the archive goes away. And there's never any evidence you even existed. So there's certainly a reward to that physical work of running a bookstore that is tangible. And it feels at the end of the day like you've done a job of work. I think, you know, obviously the benefit of journalism is that idea that you are in the trenches, on the front line. It's funny how they're all war metaphors, trying to change the world for the better. And I think what we realized is after 50 years collectively of trying to, you know, do our part in changing the conversation around tech, and I think it's safe to say in the 20-something years that overlap that we were doing that, the conversation around tech has significantly changed. We know now who tech people are. We know what they're capable of. We know their dangers. So I won't say our work here is done, but I'll say that what we've tried to do, which is to make people better understand the sheer power of tech people has been achieved. And so what we came to peace with is the idea of now we can do something else that is changing lives in a different way, in a very modest, small way, where somebody will come in, they're feeling the weight of the world, and they want a book to help them. And so most of the job, to answer your question, is helping people find that one book that will, in that moment, give them what they need, whether that's just something funny, or it's something, you know, they're dealing with some grief or some uncertainty, or they just want to sit by a pool and forget about the rest of the world. There's something just so delightful and fun about meeting people where they are, putting a book in their hand, and then having them say a few days later, oh my God, that book that you gave me, it changed my day. It changed my hour. I don't care. That's what the job is now.
One thing that I find really inspiring about this story is that you keep returning to this idea of the book as the item that changes people. As you say, maybe just changes their day, but the book itself has some intrinsic value and power and potential. And I bring this up because it seems to run counter to what we hear in the conversation about tech a lot, that people are just on their phones all the time. They've lost themselves to the feed on TikTok. Video content, short video content, is gaining so much more attention and mind share than everything else. Your experience seems to be that books, again, whether that's audiobooks or print books or whatever, but books themselves still have a place.
Yeah, so I'll say two things about that. And yeah, when I say books, I don't necessarily mean the printed codex. I mean the idea, what we all know to be a book, about 200 to 600 pages of story or, you know, thoughts on a certain topic, you know, the book. So two things that are fascinating. The first is that, yeah, this idea that we're all constantly on our phones and everything, it's all true. Of course we are. We all are constantly on our phones and everything is going to video and all that nonsense. That's all true. But what's also true is that every day, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people come into across our two stores, come in and pick up a physical book and walk out and read that book. And those people oftentimes have learned about the book that they've come to buy from TikTok, from Instagram, from social media, from texting. And so first of all, this sort of idea that the phone or technology is the enemy of the book is not borne out by our experience. And I will say, what I have seen is the younger the people are, the more likely they are to be craving a physical book, because for them, a phone is an obligation. It's a social obligation. It's a school obligation. It's a work obligation. And when they are done with those obligations and they want to relax, the last thing they need is another screen, because that screen might pop up a message telling them they have yet another obligation. And the World Economic Forum did a study on this to bear this out. The older you are, the more likely you are to be reading on a screen, and by which I mean a Kindle or whatever else. The younger you are, and this is anecdotal for us at least, but it has been borne out with studies, is we see the younger people going, I can't be on my phone. I just need a book. And so we're selling big books to, like when we first opened the Palm Springs store, I saw this whole group of individual people, like as in a collection of people came in over the course of a couple of days, all probably in their early 20s, late teens, all looking for copies of The Count of Monte Cristo. And I thought, as one might, this is for school. I assumed that some teacher had assigned this terrible giant book. I mean, it's a fantastic book, but I mean, if you're a teenager, my God, you know, you've been given this book. This was before I realized that teachers no longer assign entire books. They just assign paragraphs now, and the kids have to read on their own. But anyway, I said to one of these teens eventually, so is this for school? And they looked to me like I was an idiot. Because for a start, you don't get assigned books in school anymore. You get assigned, you know, some, you know, look at this extract and fill in a blank. No, they heard about it on TikTok. TikTok was blowing up about the Count of Monte Cristo. And I heard one kid, I'm old, so I say kid when I mean 19-year-old, explaining to their friend, oh my God, you've got to read this. Like, this guy just like gets screwed over by his friends and he just Fs them up. And it does. And I'm just like filled with this joy and surprise. You know, fast forward a few years and it no longer surprises me. The kids are doing fine. Books are doing fine. The other thing I want to say, though, about books, the power of books, is about the power of novels. Whatever we say, oh, the novel is dead. People don't read anymore. People get everything on TikTok. And yet, when anybody watches what's happening in the world, and it can be anything that's happening in the world right now, I don't care what your politics is. What do people say? They say, oh, it's like something out of 1984. Oh, it's like something out of Fahrenheit 451. Oh, it's like something out of Handmaid's Tale. Compared to how vanishingly few people go, oh, it's like an interesting column I read in The Atlantic. No one says that. What they say is, it's like something out of George Orwell. It's like something out of Margaret Atwood. It's like something out of Parable of the Sower.
Or they say it's Kafka-esque.
It's Kafka-esque. Exactly. They are talking about novels every time. When we look at the world, the novel helps us understand our world and also articulate. When we talk about AI, we talk about 2001. We talk about, you know, I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that. And it can be stories when they make it to screen as well. But typically they've come from books before. It's like something out of Jurassic Park. Every single time you hear somebody, John Grisham, like I could do this all day. This is how we understand a world, through books. Even if you say you don't read, I bet you say to yourself, this is like something out of George Orwell. It's like, yes, you do read, it turns out. You did read once, maybe do it again. But it's so important to understand that this idea the novel is dead is just nonsense. First of all, more bookstores opened last year than opened for decades. More physical print books are being sold than at any time in recorded book history, except for that 1 year during the pandemic when all we had to do was read. Books and reading are doing just fine. The ideas in books are more powerful than ever. I feel like the only people who think bookstores are dead are people who don't go in them. You will see the guy, and it's often a guy, I've got to say, you know, with all sort of self-awareness, they'll walk into the bookstore and they'll look around and they'll go, I didn't even know these existed anymore. And you think, that's a problem with you, friend. That's really, I don't know how to help you. If you didn't know the books were still a thing, I think the problem is that you haven't been paying attention to books and the world.
So you're mentioning Dumas and The Count of Monte Cristo. We talked about Kafka and Arthur C. Clarke and Michael Crichton. Do you carry all of those authors?
Oh, of course. We have about 10, you know, sort of 8,000 to 10,000 books in each store, which titles, which is nowhere near enough in the sense of I wish we had every title in the world. But actually, we pride ourselves in the fact that whatever you are looking for, we will have it. We work really hard to make sure that folks come into the store and they find what they're looking for. So yes, we have all of those, but we also have the thing for you if you've read those things. You know, I think a lot about book recommendation apps and how they usually work by just saying, what do you already like? Oh, here's something a bit like that. That's not how we recommend books to one another. We recommend books to one another correctly by saying, how are you feeling right now? That to me is we try and make sure we have a book for every feeling. And that does, unfortunately, right now, include a hell of a lot of Michael Crichton, Arthur C. Clarke. But I tell you what it also includes a lot of is Agatha Christie. I didn't see this one coming. I'm a huge Agatha Christie fan. If anyone's, you know, read The Confessions or reading The Confessions, they will know there's a lot of Agatha Christie references in there. Maud teaches Liam about right and wrong by reading an enormous amount of Agatha Christie. And there were some, and then there were none references throughout. But what I didn't realize was how much people were craving a book in which a terrible thing occurs, a terrible person has done a terrible thing, everything is in chaos. And then a person comes in and says, let me explain what's happened here. Let me explain why all this makes total sense. And then the bad person gets their comeuppance and the victim gets justice. Those books have been flying. I can't imagine why in the current world, but for some reason, those stories of making sense of awful people doing terrible things and then them getting their comeuppance have been flying off the shelves.
Well, and for that matter, Count of Monte Cristo is a great story of revenge.
Of somebody who gets, yes, completely screwed over and then and gets thrown in jail, you know, and gets their freedom taken away. So many books that were written so long ago, you read them now and you think, we humans have done these horrible things to one another for so long. And I say this about tech people a lot. If only the Elon Musks of the world, the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, had read more novels, we would not be in so much of this mess. But also, they wouldn't be in so much of this mess. You know, you can build a rocket ship or a solar panel while being a sociopath. But you try and do that, be a sociopath and run a social network, and your social network will turn into a Nazi bar real quick. And it will lose a ton of money, and it will have no future because you don't understand what makes people come together. we see this across every social network, that Mark Zuckerberg constantly trying to pivot what Meta is, calling it Meta. That didn't work. Yeah, because you don't understand people. You don't understand, we're going to call it the metaverse and everyone's going to live in a virtual world. You don't understand how the real world operates. How are you going to mimic it, you dumbass? Like, it frustrates me that for the cost of one novel, which is somewhere between $18 and $30, depending on format, they could have saved themselves billions. This is my invitation to any one of those sociopaths to come into the bookstore. We don't judge. We would love to find you the book that will help you recoup all those billions of dollars you lose by not understanding humans.
Okay, so Zuckerberg comes in and says, Paul, as an avid listener of Tectonic with Mark Hurst,
I've seen he has a tote bag.
he wears all the t-shirts.
Yeah.
I have come to the realization that I am, in fact, a sociopath. I feel regret for my past actions. And I want to turn over a new leaf by reading the novel of your choice, Paul. What is the novel for a sociopath to change their ways?
And I want to be clear that I don't know if Mark Zuckerberg is actually a sociopath. I think his behavior has been sociopathic. I'm not going to diagnose. But I'm also going to say that Sarah was one of the first journalists to ever interview Mark Zuckerberg when he was still 18 years old. And he didn't used to be... the things he did were not always this bad. He is a human being under there. And so... the answer to that is I would talk to him and I would say, how are you feeling right now? Nobody says I'm a sociopath, give me a book. You know, if somebody did say that, then I would struggle with that answer because I don't think you can fix a sociopath. No, I would want to meet him where he is. I would say specifically, what are you struggling with? Do you feel like you're overwhelmed by all of the responsibility the world has put on you? Do you feel guilty? Do you feel like, oh my God, I've done these terrible things? In which case, something like The Count of Monte Cristo might not be a bad place to start. But honestly, or a Michael Crichton, if I thought he might get a kick out of it. But it's a very personal thing. I can't diagnose what he should read without talking to him. It sounds like I'm avoiding the question, but I'm not. I think the book that somebody needs depends on the day, the time, the emotion. And this is where I think books are so magical, is I have read so many books that I never would have picked up because I'm feeling a certain way. And I say to a friend, I just feel lost. I just don't know why. They go, have you read? And they'll tell me a book, never heard of the author, never heard of it. And it fixes me. So my cop-out answer is, I would love it if Zuckerberg or anybody else came into the bookstore and said, I really feel like I've done some horrible things and didn't mean to. And I don't know if a book's going to help me fix all of them, but I would at least like to be a slightly better person. I would ask them, you know, what have they read and when can we stop? So yeah, sorry, cop-out answer, but I'm not, but it's a personal thing.
I remember years ago, I was in a difficult moment and I came across The Sports Writer by Richard Ford. Mm-hmm. And that led me to read all of the Frank Bascom novels by Richard Ford, really restorative to inhabit this character's life as he was going through his own difficult moment. But here, let me ask the self-serving question, Paul. So, because I don't want to speak for listeners and say that I know where any of my listeners are right now, but let's say for an independent radio host who is beset by national and global news every day and is feeling more than a little concerned about their trajectory, both of technology and politics, not to mention the outcomes in society and environmental degradation and so on, just feeling some weight. What's a novel that you would recommend?
You know, I loved recently because I was feeling some of those things myself. And I wanted to get a bit out of my comfort zone. I was feeling those things. There's a book came out relatively recently called Automatic Noodle by Annalee Newitz. I don't know if you've seen it. It is one of the most delightful sort of sci-fi adjacent, wonderful books. That is what I would put into your hand because I think you would get a kick out of the world described in it. But I also think it's such a nice escape from the world. I would give you that. I would give you, if it had been a month or so ago, I would have given you a copy of Hercule Poirot's Christmas, which is my favorite Agatha Christie. It's so delightful and seasonal because it's set in the winter. but it also has an oligarch getting their comeuppance in a violent way, in a way that's just delightful. And it was actually Agatha Christie wrote it because somebody said to her that they didn't think there was enough blood in her novels, and she said, I'll show you. So I'd probably put one of those two into your hands right now, because they're both just escapist enough while also not denying reality. I think the problem with escapism is if you go too far, you find yourself itching to at least be grounded back in the real world. So those, Automatic Noodle, I think, is my immediate answer, because it's just my utter favorite at the moment, and I think you'd get a kick out of it. And then I'd obviously put a copy of The Confessions in the bag as well, because that's the self-serving answer. It's what I also tell Mark Zuckerberg. I tell everyone who came into the store, The Confessions will solve all of your problems. But then
after you read The Confessions, may I recommend Agatha Christie? Right.
An actual book I think you'd like. Yes, exactly. is probably Automatic Noodle or any, this is the wonderful thing about books as well, is thousands of them come out every week. It's like there is a book for every mood at every moment. It's so wonderful.
How can listeners find out more about your growing bookstore chain, Paul? And if they're in
Empire,
Palm Springs, or San Francisco, actually go to visit, how do they get that information?
They can go to bestbookstore.com, which will have the address of both, or they could just come see us. We're at La Plaza in Palm Springs, which is right downtown. It's right off Palm Canyon, right in the middle of town. And in San Francisco, we're in Union Square, where if you follow the Macy's round down Powell Street, that's where we are on that block. So basically, you know, you can't miss us. And we have a big neon sign in the window. So bestbookstore.com will get you there if you can't find us. I will say for your New York and other listeners, we ship anywhere in the world. And we would be delighted to sell a book to you that way as well. And you can also email us with your own existential crises, and we'll match the book to you as well.
Okay, bestbookstore.com. Listeners, tell them that Tectonic sent you.
Yes, we will, and we will give you a special hug.
Paul Bradley Carr, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Let's do this again sometime.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, let's not leave it 4 years next time. I gotta write more books so I can come on sooner.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remaining few minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with novelist Paul Bradley Carr, whose latest is called The Confessions. As I said earlier, this today is Paul's third visit to Tectonic. Now, the first time he was on in 2021, he was talking about his previous novel, 1414 Degrees, another techno dystopia, that one based in San Francisco. And then he was on a couple years after that talking about Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter, and today talking about The Confessions. And one thing I found really intriguing about the premise of that book is that you've got, as I said earlier, a globe-spanning, all-powerful AI that is defined by its feelings of regret, of contrition, and a desire to make things better, which is, frankly, it's not the kind of AI that we are seeing currently in the world. So I think that contrast makes it an interesting setup for a story. Imagine if an AI was very different from the AI platforms that we have currently in the world. And that contrast also is highlighted by what I talked about last week. If you heard the show, I talked about, speaking of Elon Musk, his AI chatbot called Grok and what it has been enabling as Musk has installed it on Twitter/X. And as a result, there has been a wave of Grok-generated AI deepfakes that have ended up spreading non-consensual pornographic imagery all over the internet, chiefly of women and, most disgustingly, of children. There's also violent content, racist content, anti-Semitic content. And seeing that as the output of one of the best funded AI platforms in the world, one has to think, what trajectory are we on if we are spending all of our trillions, spending or investing all of our treasure, not from your choice or my choice, friends, but from the choice of eight dudes on the west coast of the US, we're spending a gigantic amount of treasure to build out AI systems that are doing what? That are having these horrible, nightmarish effects in the world. And you know, thinking about that news and trying to spotlight it for you on last week's show, it left me feeling kind of weighed down. And how could it not, you know, if you really engage what's happening in technology? And that's why, coming full circle, that's why I was so happy to have Paul Bradley Carr on the show today, so that we could have this interesting conversation about a different kind of AI in his book, The Confessions, and also an inspirational story from his own life, a real life story of Paul and his wife, Sarah, who have started this bookstore chain, the best bookstore, and evidently are getting so much satisfaction out of helping people when they come into the store, pointing them to a book that is going to enrich their lives in some way. And I can only hope that for all of us, friends, that we all find something in this next year, some project or some transition or some new habit or some new hobby or some new experience that will bring some light and relieve some of this weight. And by the way, if you have your own suggestions for novels, for what would reduce or lighten the load of an independent radio host or maybe your fellow listeners, you can email me. I'm at mark@tectonic.fm. That's mark@tectonic.fm. And you can get all the links to Paul and his book and all sorts of other past shows on the Tectonic website, which is at tectonic.fm. That is T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And to finish out, we're going to hear a song by the band Declu that features Tectonic listener Carl. The song is called Real Friends, and Carl says that it's a song about falling into the mirror of social media. Until then, until I play this, friends, you are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. And I do have a little bit of homework for all of you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, friends, get off Google. Have a great week. I'll see you next time. Reactions.
Always say we're friends, time and time again. Real friends.
Is this real or reaction? Feel myself losing traction. Is this real or reflection? The mirror flipped my direction. Away from you, away with you. I'm scared to move. Are you scared to move?
And after that magical 38 seconds, here we are again with another edition of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm proudly occupying this chair every Monday evening at 7 p.m., following hot on the heels of Mark Hurst's Tectonic Show. Always a joy and a pleasure to be here playing music for you, and I have plenty this week. We're going to start with something from a group called Guapo. That's G-U-A-P-O. They are an English band, and we're going to hear a track from an album released in 2004 called Five Sons, and one selling point, one reason I must play this track is the screeching mellotron you'll hear. And again, the group is Guapo. We're going to hear Five Sons 2 is the title of this piece from the album Five Sons.